No, you know, when I came out to LA, it was 1981. And as soon as I got my feet wet in the business, I realized that just playing music as a bass player, I wanted to know more about the music scene as a whole versus just me being a musician. So I learned from the best writers, arrangers, producers, engineers. So learning all the facets of music when from idea to final creation.
Welcome to episode 115 of the Bass Shed Podcast. My name is Ryan Roberts. All right, what's up, folks? What's up, folks? Welcome to the Bass Shed Podcast. I feel like there's a ton of stuff. I feel like there's a ton of stuff going on, but I'm not exactly sure where to start here. Jerry Jermont. Let's start with Jerry Jermont. Let's start with Mr. Jerry Jermont. Jerry and I are compiling a transcription book of his bass lines. He came to the studio a few weeks ago and brought a thumb drive with his favorite bass lines that he's played on, covering a variety of the legendary artists he's worked with. I started to transcribe them. The book should be out very, very soon. It's a super cool project to be involved with, and I'm really excited to be doing this with Jerry. Stop by thebassshedacademy.org. There'll be information about the tunes and bass lines that are a part of the book, along with pre-order discounts. You can also check out the masterclass he did at Lemur Music back in September. In its entirety, there's no edits on it. It is recorded from beginning to end as presented in real life. Again, all of that is available at thebassshedacademy.org. All right. What else? NAMM show time. NAMM show time again, right? I'm interested to see what's up this year. Last year kind of sucked. As far as like a bass presence at NAMM. So we'll see. We'll see what the NAMM show is talking about in 2024. I don't exactly know what days I'm going to be there yet. There's another conference happening in Southern California. I might also attend that. I am a member of the Southern California Band and Orchestra Association, and they're having their conference the same weekend. I feel like the band and orchestra folk are probably not NAMM folk. So they are having their conference the same weekend. I know what you're thinking. Ryan, the Southern California Band and Orchestra Association sounds like an absolute rager. Why don't you just party with them all weekend, right? I know, everything about that implies that it's basically going to be Woodstock 2024. Come on. School Band and Orchestra Association? Woof. That is a party. Anyways, I mean, I'm still a part of it, so I can't really talk poorly about it. So who knows what will happen. I would like to attend, but that is one packed weekend. I will have to see how the dust settles, what I end up going to, but I will definitely be at NAMM. And I will say this about NAMM. My folks at Trickfish have a brilliant NAMM strategy, which is they put their amps in other booths. So you can check out Trickfish stuff on anybody's bass. It's pretty killing. So it's not just like, you know, the Trickfish booth and they have a couple basses and you hear their amps with a set number of basses, makes, models, pickup configurations, whatever. Like, they put their amps in other booths. I think that's brilliant. So if you're at NAMM and you see Trickfish in one of the booths, stop by, play on it, check it out. I'm a big fan of their products. And, you know, definitely a special thanks to Trickfish for sponsoring and being involved with the Jerry Jermont Masterclasses. Jerry Jermont is a Trickfish artist. Big fan of Trickfish stuff. So again, if you're at NAMM and you see the Trickfish in a booth, stop by, play on it. Most importantly, if you're going to NAMM, wear comfortable shoes and bring earplugs. That's the name of the game for the NAMM show, no matter what year you go. Lemur Music, everything you need for the double bass. Lemur Music is running a special right now. For every $100 spent, you'll receive a coupon for $10 off. You can also use the promo code TheBassShed, all one word, to save 10% on your order of any amount. I was teaching a lemur last week. They have some new leatherwood rosin in stock and colorful end pin tips that are really cool. So stop by lemurmusic.com and check it out. Lemur Music is also sponsoring a masterclass by Dr. Matt Hare, the principal bassist of the Mozart Classical Orchestra and the Long Beach Ballet. Dr. Hare's masterclass will be performed on the world-famous Why so complicated with the last names here? You guys know who I'm talking about. If you don't know Kusevitsky. Classical guys, you know what I'm talking about. The world-famous Kusevitsky. I'm trying to sound it out here. I don't know if that's working. Kusevitsky. There it is. Kusevitsky. The world-famous Kusevitsky bass. For more information about the masterclass and the Kusevitsky bass, stop by thebassshedacademy.org/news to go all the way back. Dr. Matt Hare will be performing on this bass on the Kusevitsky. I feel like I've also heard it Kuskavitsky. Like I feel like I've heard that, but when it's written, that doesn't quite make sense. I don't know. Maybe it's, you know, a foreign language thing. Kuskavitsky. Now I'm vibing myself out. I can't even get it right. Anyways, stop by thebassshedacademy.org/news. And in other news, I will try to learn how to read. No guarantees on that one, though. All right, on the episode is John Pena. John Pena is originally from Puerto Rico, then spent some time in New York, and is currently in Southern California. Pena stays incredibly active as a session and touring bassist, along with being an arranger, writer, producer, and engineer. This cat has a very diverse skill set and has worked with an equally diverse list of musicians, including Larry Carlton, Joe Sample, Diana Ross, Christopher Cross, Barry Manilow, Dionne Warwick, Nina Simone, Celia Cruz, Ricky Martin, Michael Brecker, Chick Corea, Carlos Santana, Kenny G, Steve Vai, Chaka Khan, and so many others. Like, honestly, I can't think of any other musician that I've even heard of that has worked with both Ricky Martin and Michael Brecker. Like, what? It's insane. I first heard John live in this small club in LA called Mambo's, which doesn't exist anymore. He was there playing with David Garfield, and I was really, really blown away and captivated by his playing. I was hooked, and since I've been doing the podcast, it's been, you know, always in the back of my brain to get in touch with John and see if he was available to come on and do an episode. And thankfully, the schedule's worked out. Yeah, and it was great. It was an honor to have him on the podcast. John has been working on a 3-album collection titled Life, Legacy, and Music. That's kind of one that's quite an undertaking, right? Just boom, I'm doing 3 records, you know, just like this really sizable project that's 3 records deep. Our conversation starts with us talking about this project of his, and here it is. Here's my talk with Mr. John Pena. How you doing, man?
I'm good, man.
Nice.
Staying occupied as always.
What's with what? What do you got today? What are you working on today?
Well, I'm actually finishing parts 2 and 3 of the Life, Legacy, and Music project that I've been working on. So
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about that. When that's quite an endeavor that you undertook, doing a three record set, I guess, three record project.
Yeah, basically it's really just a continuation of the music that I'm trying to put together in one. I was going to do one very long double
Okay.
album, but these days attention span is not all that great with most folks, so I'd rather just break it up and simplify it a little bit. But
Okay.
it's basically it encompasses my life's work, heritage, faith, all of the above, different styles of music that I like playing and arranging, and stuff that other friends of mine wrote and arranged, and that we worked on together, playing whatever. It's just fun stuff.
That's
And
great.
yeah, so this first one is out now, and it's a lot of fun. I call it the appetizer. The part two is going to be more like the main course. There's going to be a lot more meat to dig into
Okay.
musically and vocally too. They all
Oh.
have vocal tunes, and there's several instrumental tunes as well. So it's a combination of everything. Yeah.
How long before you started the recording process did you kind of storyboard the whole project? And
About
like,
a year and a half ago.
okay.
About a year
So
and a
it's,
half ago.
yeah, it's been in the works for a minute then. How much of the material did you have written at the time?
A lot of it was written. I would say 70% of it was already. Some
Okay.
of it was recorded 25, 30 years ago, and we just revived a lot of the stuff and changed
Oh,
the
cool.
arrangement, changed the, instrumentation. I like to redo my basses and stuff. And
Yeah.
then some of them was as recent as the last few months,
Okay.
So yeah, it's a like I said, it's a variation. I was trying to find a variation of the music that I enjoy playing, and stuff that kind of not just features the bass, but features the music and the arrangements,
Right,
and
right.
vocalists and stuff. Just trying to get it to be more musical,
Who are some as a composer, producer, either coming into this record or other ones you've done who have been an influence on you? Who are some maybe people throughout history where you can kind of like, yeah, they shaped my concept a little bit. As far as putting records together, not just bass players.
There's too many to mention, but
Of course.
influences, I would say, as I'll just say, bass players, one of them was Stanley Clarke. As far as musicians, artists, Steely Dan, because the way they record their records, they're impeccably great sounding stuff. I mean, a lot of those old records still stand up today in the mixes. A lot of engineers, when they do sound check, they use the Steely Dan stuff to kind of get their speakers in
Dialed in.
lined up,
Yeah.
dialed in.
I was just at the potato last night talking about Steely Dan and engineering about I forgot what track it was, and maybe even the record. I just remember talking about this, that the engineer on the Steely Dan record won a Grammy for like where he placed the snare or how he mic'd the snare on one specific thing. And obviously Steely Dan is notorious for being incredibly meticulous in the studio.
Very much so.
Did you kind of bring in a lot of that meticulousness? Is that kind of how you work also?
Well, more meticulous as far as sound and placement, but back then they recorded most of the stuff on tape, so there was 2-inch reels, and they spliced away all that tape, so to get everything to get it the way they wanted it. These days it's all digital. I didn't have to do that much because the drummers pretty much do their thing, and I just get the placement sound wise where I want it.
Okay.
So yeah.
Cool. So, did you have a co-producer on this with you, or was it all just kind of you at the helm?
Yeah, it's pretty much me at the helm. It's
Nice.
my baby, so to speak.
Cool.
So cool. Yeah, part one's out. Part two mm-hmm. and three is we're working on. Are just about getting ready to finish a few overdubs in part two, and then get it to mastering, and hopefully I'll get it out later this year. Nice. And then, yeah, part three will be out next year, and we're still working on some of the tunes, and I'm still getting musicians to come and do some overdubs and stuff, because, you know, as you well know, to get guys on schedule. Yeah. and some musicians are there, some in Italy, some guys are in France, some guys are in Mexico, New York, you know, different places. So the beautiful thing is having the technology to make it happen. So it's been fun. It's been great.
Yeah. Now, have you dealt with that? Like having people cut in different parts of the world and still kept a very, it still kept a feeling as if it wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, that's always the downfall with that type of recording process.
Yeah. Most of the time I'm present.
Okay.
Whether it's through Zoom, like we're doing right now.
Sure.
We use, what's the program? Audio Movers. Mm-hmm. So that I can hear exactly what they're doing. For example, with Greg Bissonette, he's got a setup in LA, because I'm 2 hours away from LA.
Okay.
And so we were able to be in the studio at the same time, even though I'm here home.
Yeah.
And I got to hear exactly what he was hearing. And then I could say, you know, Greg, let's try this in the B section, and let's do this in the bridge, and, you know, let's change this accent and let's fix this, you know. So, you know, I'm producing as we're going.
Okay.
And that's kind of been how it's been done, you know, when I'm doing overdubs with cats that are, we're doing it remotely.
Yeah.
Some of the tracks we're recorded with the whole rhythm section together as well. So,
oh, cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So like the Mr. Bottomy, we had recorded that together at Doug Bossi's studio. So we had most of the rhythm section pretty much there, and then we just added the overdubs. You know.
Nice. So the first part one of Life, Legacy, and Music, it's 7 tracks. How did you go about selecting which 7 would make the cut for part one? What tunes are going to be on part two? Which ones ended up on part three?
That's a good question. I started out with about 30 to 35 tunes.
Okay.
To kind of start honing in on the versatility, variety, vocals versus horns versus rock guitars versus, you know, just trying to mix it up so that it had a little bit of for everybody, you know?
Yeah.
So basically that's kind of how I worked it and honed in on it. Also still thinking, you know, about the bass. I mean, it have to feature some of it, some, mm-hmm. you know, the bass, because it's basically about the bass, you know, it's what I've done in my lifetime. But the fun part really is being able to play all the different types of basses on the record. So, you know, back when I was growing up, most artists or bass players, they were known for the one sound.
Right, right.
And which was a great thing. I can tell when Stanley Clarke's playing versus yeah. Marcus Miller versus, you know, all these great bass players, you know it's them. But for me, because I was more of a studio guy than an artist, it was about finding the instrument that worked best with the song.
Sure.
At that time, and the style of music. So I have quite a big arsenal of basses from 4 to 6 string, 4, 5, 6 fretlesses, you know, uprights and acoustic fretlesses and stuff. So I just try and find the right instrument for that tune.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been the fun part. And then making sure that sonically it's sounding right, you know?
Right, right. Was there one bass you used more of on the record that was kind of like, if you look at all three volumes, all three parts of the record, is there one bass that makes an appearance more than others?
Not really.
Really?
No.
That's diverse.
Yeah, pretty diverse. Yeah. You know, I used two Fender basses. One was a Precision. The other one was a Jazz bass, but they both been modified.
Okay.
The jazz bass was modified by Sadowski. The precision was modified by Seymour Duncan, Kevin Beller, who's my tech guy there at Seymour Duncan. And then from that point on, I used, the T-Bass. It's a five-string that was made for me in England. Mm. Then there's the Warwick five-string fretless. Then there's the Moon Bass. It's a six-string fretless. Then I have several exotic basses that also been modified by Seymour Duncan, electronics and pickups, and Miura basses as mm-hmm. well that have been modified by Seymour Duncan.
I gotta ask about this because I was just going down the rabbit hole of modding a PJ I have. And so I was looking at all kinds of pickups. What do you specifically like about the Seymour Duncan pickups, and which Seymour Duncans do you use? You mentioned. Well, go ahead.
To be honest, most of them are single coil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like to use the jazz setup, but some of them have double coil setups. You know,
okay.
But I always like to have a switch to switch the double coil to single coil because it gives me a whole different dynamic.
Sure.
But to be honest, I'm more specific about frequencies
mm-hmm.
and sweepable mids.
Yeah, it was just selecting a frequency with a sweep option.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And so Kevin there at Seymour, pretty much he knows my ears and what I like, and I have spent time there at the factory, so we've like with the Fender Precision Bass, I mean, we went, sat there and went through sounds and stuff. And then
okay.
the kind of winding that he'll give me options of the kind of winding and stuff. And to be honest, I can't tell you exactly which models I pick up and okay. electronics because each one is so different. And
sure.
I would have to look at the graphics of each one,
yeah.
but I just love the sound that he's got, you know, that he's gotten me because, for example, the P bass, which they modified, I've been playing that since the 90s. I did a lot of Brandon Fields records
okay.
back then and commercials, lots of commercials and mm-hmm. everybody, the producers, please bring the P bass.
Really?
You know, they just love the way you just plug it in and the sound was there. So for rock stuff, for funk, for jazz, it didn't matter, you know.
How would you classify this P bass that's so acknowledged? Do you think it's more of a modern sound or does it have more of a vintage sound?
I would say more of a modern sound.
Okay, but it's not active or it is active?
It is active.
Okay.
Yes. And
there you go. That's the modern sound.
Yeah, all of them are active, as a matter of fact. But I do have a bypass to make them, you know, to go back to sort of the vintage
sound
as well. So I can alter them.
Yeah. It's a weird thing I'm having, and maybe you can speak to this because of your frequencies and your attention to frequencies specifically. I have with my P bass, like it's not cutting the way I want it to in a mix. What frequency would you diagnose that as to get like a really good cut out of a P bass that's still fat and supportive and all the things that we know and love from P basses? Would you be able to define what frequency that is?
Well, you're talking about active, right? And actives.
Yeah, just on a frequency scope. Like if I had to boost something or cut something else, whether it was on an external preamp or on board, what would those frequencies be?
The P bass naturally is pretty thumpy, and if you're using traditional P bass pickups, you're going to get a lot of thumpiness. So if you want to get to be a bit more modern sounding, then you're going to work frequencies between, I would say, between 4 and 6K.
Oh.
Somewhere around there that it might get you the highs without being too high, brittle or whatever
right.
the call is, you know.
Yeah, like what's the tone knob at? The tone knob is what, 5K?
The tone is...
on like a passive P, you know, just a Fender tone knob.
I don't think it even goes up to 5K, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah. I think it's below low 1K.
Oh, man.
On the tone up, if it's maybe, passive.
Yeah, like maybe passive. Around 800 or something, like a high mids.
Between 500 and 800, I would
yeah.
say.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah,
I've been geeking out on this hard, like checking out like the different types of magnets and, you know, yes. Amico twos, threes, fives, well, ceramics.
And the way they wind the pickups too is
I know.
Makes a big difference. But what I do, to be honest, with my P-Bass, I did a J to J setup. That's how I got it modified. So I'm not using P-Bass pickups. I'm using J to J pickups.
Mm.
But, you know, I had them the way Kevin wound them were slightly different.
Are they a little overwound for like a really punchy sound?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. And you'll hear that on the record, especially in part two.
Okay.
You'll hear that. That bass is, I used it on several tunes in part two.
Nice.
And for the slap thing, it's really crisp and punchy in your face. And, you know,
I have a bass here that Howard Ouye custom built a pickup for. He does pickups for F basses and stuff. And I kind of didn't know what I wanted. I just gave him a concept of sound. He's like, man, do you want it overwound? I'm like, what does that do? Sure, let's try it. And now I understand the overwound sound, you know, because I have it on this fret list.
Yeah.
Damn, is it punchy?
Yeah.
Like, sometimes I have to be like, all right, settle down. Like, that's too much.
Yeah, the mirror basses that I play also are that way, the way they are wound. So they almost tend to sound like a double coil pickup.
Okay, yeah.
Especially when you're playing a finger style, but it's not double coil. It's still a single coil. It's just, you know, more overwound, as you say.
Right.
And so the pickup is thicker. It's wider. So it's wider this way as well as the winding.
Right. So taller, for people that can't maybe see what you just did, it's taller from like the portion of the body that would be up against your personal body towards the outside of the strings. Like it's the depth of the pickup as it sits in the bass.
Yeah, the depth. Yeah. And also how it goes from the top of the where the strings are going into the cavity of of the bass is a little wider there too.
Oh, so you can get some extra winding in there. Wow, yes. Those are running hot.
Yes.
Those are running hot.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So you can do a lot, especially if you have sweepable mids and you can control your highs and lows.
Right.
It's a huge variety of tones. Yeah. And then I did a brass nut on the P-Bass. Because I wanted a little bit of more bite and a metallic sound, especially for the rock stuff.
Even
going more metal rock sound.
Yeah.
With pick and using a metal pick to go with that. And, you know, once you combine that with the distortion, it gives you, you know, it gets raunchy.
Did you? Which is nice. Like, I always associate the badass bridge with that kind of sound, too. That really edgy, metallic-y sound.
Yeah.
Did you switch out the bridge to kind of give it
switched out, and it's very similar to the badass. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. That's very killer, similar. Man. Yeah.
Back to the record. What was the catalyst for at this point in your career doing this project now, like specifically right now in your career?
Yeah. Well, the first thing is I'm getting older, dude.
Join the club, man. Join the club.
So the sad thing is, even on my record, a couple of the guys have passed away that are on the record. Mm. So, I'm also honoring them.
Yeah.
Because they're phenomenal musicians. A couple of the guys that are on the record are just amazing musicians. One was Marc Biacco, who's from France. He's a singer. Mm-hmm. And he was doing Take Six stuff before Take Six really like exploded with all the vocal stuff. But he was one guy. And he did it in the studio. So he's done a few we did a few tracks that a couple of tracks, actually three tracks, that he did all the vocal stuff. And one of the tunes, Michael Brecker is soloing on.
Oh, wow.
And oh my God, it's ridiculous. And it's one of Michael's tunes that we cut. And, but he's doing all the
previously recorded? Like what mic?
He recorded it for his record back in the 90s.
Okay.
But it was very, there wasn't a whole lot more instrumentation involved except the vocals and the sax.
Okay.
Right? So now we're incorporating drums, bass, you know, putting all of the stuff around it.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I loved all those Brecker records from the 90s.
Man. Oh, awesome. Awesome stuff. Records. And he was one of my heroes. So, you know, so homage to Michael. And then also Ramon Senyero, who's an amazing guitar player in L.A., who was in demand all the time. He played every style of music, had every exotic type of guitar that he could play. So everybody was hiring him, from pop music to jazz to you name it. And we did a few records with Alex Acuna and the Unknowns.
Okay.
And you can hear him there on that record, especially because he solos a lot on those records. But he was just an amazing guy. He incredibly talented, great guitar player, and had all these different tones and sounds. And so, yeah, we lost him recently. So, you know, it's that one of the reasons why I'm doing this is, besides getting older, is trying to have all my buddies on the record, you know, because there's so many people that I have relationship with musically around the globe. And it's been fun getting them all to be a part of it. You know,
that's awesome. That's awesome. You're originally from New York and then came up in Puerto Rico. When did you move to the States?
Well, I was born and raised in New York City.
I mean, yeah, but back to the States after Puerto Rico.
I went to Puerto Rico during my junior high and high school years.
Okay.
And that's, I learned Spanish there. And then I came back, I would say, mid-70s, 75, 76. I came back to the States. I was in New York for a minute. Then I went to Florida. And I was in Florida for about 3 years. And I worked a top 40 gig there, and I was just saving my money because I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a studio musician. Mm-hmm. That's what all I wanted to do. So I was listening to all the studio players, all the guys that were doing a lot of the records back then, and saved my money. Was doing a lot of 6 to 8 hour practice daily at home when I wasn't doing the night gigs, you know, the top 40 gigs. And I was always making great money, so I saved up, and I decided it was either New York or L.A. Since I'd never been to L.A. and I had gotten spoiled with the weather in Puerto Rico, I wanted to go to the semi-tropical, even though it's not as tropical, but having the 3D vibe, because Florida is pretty flat, you know, California, and I've never been. But I have friends here in California that had kind of come the year before. So I got to crash at their pad for about a week. I had enough money to get an apartment quickly. So it only took me about a week to find a place and get started. Went and joined the union at the local 47.
Sure.
Started doing casuals and, you know, working here and there, word of mouth. Started meeting guys. One of the guys that we were doing casuals together was Frank Gambale, who's playing with Chick Corea.
Sure.
You know, and we became great friends.
Was this around the time of the Electric Band?
Way before.
Okay.
Before. We were doing just casuals. None of us were known. None of us had worked with anybody yet.
Right.
But we enjoyed working with each other, and we kept saying to each other, man, you're going to go places, dude. Yeah. You're going places.
Yeah.
And a couple of years later, you know, he's touring with the Electric. I was touring with Tony Maria and, you know, Joe Sample and the Crusaders. And it's on and on. And everybody just got busy working with all these different artists and doing studio work. So, yeah, it was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's great, man. How obviously the studio musician thing has taken a drastic decline in the last, with technology being so available and easy to use. How have you navigated that professionally? You spent more time on the road to kind of, you know, balance out not being in the studio as much?
No, you know, when I came out to LA, it was 1981. And as soon as I got my feet wet in the business, I realized that just playing music as a bass player, I wanted to know more about the music scene as a whole versus just me being a musician. So I learned from the best writers, arrangers, producers, engineers. So learning all the facets of music when from idea to final creation was what I decided to get into. So I learned all the different facets. So it wasn't just playing music in the studio or touring with artists, but it was also writing and producing, putting songs out on TV and film, you know, just all the different engineering. You know, I was mixing records and doing all kinds of different things, producing young artists. So I got involved in all of the, pretty much most of the facets of the music industry. And so, and learning all those, you know, into wearing different hats, of course. And so it was fun for me. I enjoyed, I'm geeky in that way too, where technology was always my friend. Before I became a professional musician, I was into computers. Okay. And I wanted to fly jet planes. So that was my, yeah, and that was it. And then music, you know, stepped into my life. Thanks. Well, my dad taught me music since I was six, but I didn't know I was going to, be a professional musician until I was probably, in my mid teens, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, music took over and it's been a blessing. I guess that's the way I can put it together, you know?
You mentioned Stan Lee early being a big influence. Who were some other influences when you were young around this time? Say 17, 18, 16, 17, 18, maybe some records you were listening to or some.
Yeah. Something. Of course.
What are some records that really you caught there's the bug?
So many. I would say there is Ron Carter and Tony Williams were guys that I actually saw in person with Herbie Hancock and, you know, Wayne Shorter in New York. That just blew my mind, you know, blew my mind listening to those guys interact together and play, and the contrarhythms between Ron and Tony, you know.
Sure.
There, so that was one group of guys, and of course Jaco Pastorius, you know, he changed the vocabulary.
He changed the whole landscape of what it means to play the bass.
He changed the whole vocabulary on bass and, you know, brought in the melodic. And so, yeah, those guys were just. And then, of course, there were all the Latin players like Cachao from Cuba, who was playing just, you know, he played everything, you know, from song to, you know, Afro-Cuban through timba, you know, you name it, he played everything. And he's classically trained, you know, musicians. So, and the list goes on. There are so many guys. And then, of course, when I came to LA, I met so many amazing bassists. And so we all kind of rubbed off each other.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, I'm going to take a little bit of that. And yet we all kind of like learned off each other's stuff, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. But there was no necessarily pivotal records or recordings during this time. I think that's kind of where I was initially curious about, is if there was like, or you heard a record and it's just like, yeah, I want to do that, or I want to get more into that, or what's going on there, like some records that really caught your attention early on.
Yeah, well, to be honest, in New York, I used to listen to radio a lot, and back then there was no such thing as R&B radio, rock radio, classical radio. You know, I listened to one station and heard all the different styles.
Okay.
And that's what got to me from, you know, from listening to a classical orchestration piece to Mahavishnu Orchestra to, you know, it was so diverse. And then you hear the Rolling Stones and you hear, you know, Aerosmith or whatever. It was exciting. And I loved the fact that it was just music. It wasn't this or that. As far as records that really hit me hard was Heavy Weather, of course, from Weather
Report. Oh, yeah. Sure.
Was one of those when I heard it, was like, oh my God, what is this?
Yeah. Then it must have been kind of surreal the first time you're playing with Alex Acuna.
Absolutely.
After being a Heavy Weather fan. Yeah.
Totally. He was one of my heroes, and a friend of mine actually from Puerto Rico invited me to go to the Baked Potato to meet him because, you know, I am from Puerto Rican descent.
Yeah.
And so we knew a lot of the same people there in the island, musicians. So he introduced me to him at the break at the Baked Potato, and we talked and we had a great time chatting. And then he just said, "Hey, man, you want to do this audition on Monday?" And I said, "Of course."
Yeah. Yeah.
And so he gave me the address. I go over there and I get to the place, and it was actually his house in his garage. And I'm
okay.
I'm going, "So where are the other guys, Alex? Where is everybody?" He says, "Yeah. Oh, no, man, it's just us. It's just you and me." I said, "Cool. All right." So we plug in and we played, I don't know, maybe about 60 minutes, an hour, a little over an hour. We're okay. Both sweating in the garage and stuff.
Yeah.
And he says, "Hold on a second." And he picks up the phone and calls and he says, "Hey, I got the bass player." And he hangs up. He says, "You got the gig." I said, "What gig is that?" He says, "Tony Maria." And so he gave me the music and he gave me a booklet about this thick of music. And he says, "We got a couple of months before we hit the road." And he says, "You got this." And I said, "Cool.
Sweet."
So, and we had a blast too. It was a great band.
Yeah.
Great
band. Who else was in it at the time?
Well, at that time, it was Alex on drums, Luis Conte on percussion,
ooh,
Tanya and myself. It was always a quartet. She expanded later, but then Alex, of course, got busy in the studio and the movies. Luis got busy in the studio and the movies and also touring with other artists. And so then Joey Heredia was one of the charmers that played with us, as well as Wilfredo Regis Jr. And then and Ron Powell was the percussionist at after Luis, got busy.
Yeah.
Ron Powell and we and that band, Joey, Ron Powell, and myself, we did at least almost a couple of years touring with Tanya.
Oh, wow.
And that was fun. That was a great, great band.
Yeah.
And that's when I met Michael Brecker and all those other cats. Eddie Gomez, another great freaking bass player, you know, from New York, New Yorican cat.
Yeah.
Who was killing it with Steps Ahead and
No, yeah. I mean,
so for me as a kid.
Yeah,
you know, 20 something years old, seeing those guys backstage, it was like, yeah.
Not only like his work with Bill Evans, but like Steps Ahead, like I got him on some Steve Gadd Gang records, where he sounds great. I mean, he always sounds great, but
always. Yeah.
Steps Ahead was one of my favorite bands that I think never really got some attention that should have.
I think radio started getting too segregated, and the arts of music started to get lost in there. And so I love pop music. I love all music. You know,
yeah.
I always there's good music. And so it, for me, you know, obviously it's a personal taste for each person, but you know, good enough, so good. That's pretty much it. And their stuff was just exceptional. You know, the music, the arrangements, the way they interacted with soloing and movements. It was just so musical.
Yeah.
You know, so
musical. And it was still listener friendly. It wasn't improvised music that was going to lose anybody. Like really strong melodies. Not so complex.
Grooves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They had a bunch of, they went through, like, I have a record with Daryl Jones on bass. I have a record with Mark Johnson on bass. Eddie Gomez was on bass. There's always nice to listen to as a bass player because there was so many different dudes
and
through
that
band.
They all sounded great, you know.
Yeah.
They all did incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. When's so you said later this year part two will be out?
Hopefully I'm going to say late December maybe.
Okay.
Around there.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a interesting time. To difficult, it seems like, maybe to get a record done. And now, like when you get the holidays, I don't know if you travel for the holidays or not, but that's, you know, I always feel like starting around October until like the beginning of February is just kind of a wash.
Yeah.
Well, on getting projects done.
Yeah. Remember that I had started this a year and a half ago. So I have all the material.
Okay.
Most of, if not everything, has been recorded except for the overdubs right now. That's pretty much what's left. Part two, all the music is done.
Okay.
And everything is already pre-mixed. So we're really close to finalization. The only thing I'm adding now are vocals. You know, I'm doing adding harmony vocals and things to different tunes. and not just myself, but you know, other singers that are going to be involved that are doing adding some harmonies here and there to make give it some more interest, more depth.
Yeah. But,
other than that, it's like two or three tunes. That part two will be done before I go on tour with Olita Adams next month. Okay. So before I go on tour, that's going to be all done. So nice. I'm not even worried about that. Yeah, because all I have to do is get it to mastering. And, you know, I got my buddy Peter Dole at 21st Century Mastering. And so he worked at Capitol Records for ages, and we've known each other for so long. So he's got it down. You know, he knows what I want. And so I just send him the stuff, and it'll be ready by then.
What did you send the people that are on the record, the other musicians? What did you send them? Did you send them a reference track, like kind of a mock-up? Did you send them a chart?
Some of them had mock-ups. Almost everybody had charts.
Okay.
Yeah, there were some mock-ups, and so they didn't hear like the whole thing, but basically the basic stuff.
Yeah, the structure overall. Yeah,
structure and stuff. But some of the stuff I had to be there because it required there was some more intricate stuff with the arranging and what I wanted specifically. I could write things down, but I also go for feel, so I'd rather get some more expression out of them and their interpretation versus me saying, no, I want you to do this and do this. But still, it has to capture what I'm, and, you know, the emotion that I'm trying to get out of the tune.
Sure. Sure.
You know, and the idea. So
I think that brings up an interesting point when it comes to writing. How much room do you purposely leave for the instrumentalist to have, like, because you can dictate a whole part for him and you could write out here, play that, and then you just send it to a professional who can execute the part.
Yeah.
How much of it do you kind of look for their personal musicianship to influence your idea?
Yeah. Luckily for me, because I know all the guys that are doing solos and stuff, I pretty much know how they express themselves. Some guys I need to leave like a lot of room so they can build and do what they do with their solos.
Yeah.
And some cats are okay with 16 bars, you know, 32 bars, right?
Right.
So it just all depends on who I'm asking to do the solo stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And a lot of the stuff that I did personally is just short little things that are part of the arrangement. But there, you know, there is at least a song or two in each part of the Life, Legacy, and Music that there is a bass solo. Mm-hmm. But that's it. Everybody else gets to partake, you know? And a lot of the guys, again, they're my friends, so I know what they do, so I leave space for them to develop, you know.
Right, so there was kind of a personalization within, like if you know you're going to have, you know, studio guy A on this record,
right,
and this track, well then you can write the thing,
yes,
with him in mind.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
That's
exactly.
That's super helpful.
Yeah,
that's, yes, as of course. A composer too, like it kind of helps put some boundaries on it that you can work within.
Yes.
In an interesting way.
Yeah. Otherwise, you're kind of shooting in the dark if you don't know who you're working with and what they're capable of doing, et cetera, you know. So, yeah.
We'll be back right after this.
All right, folks. Get heard on the Bay Shed podcast. I am opening up the middle of the show to talk about what you all are up to. Stop by thebayshed.com, click on Get Featured, and let me know what news you'd like me to share. If it's upcoming gigs, if it's your website, if it's your social media handles, if it is your YouTube page, whatever it is, stop by thebayshed.com, click on Get Featured, and exactly that, Get Featured on the Bay Shed podcast. All right, I will also take this time right now to talk about the transcription book with Jerry Jamont. Go by thebayshedacademy.org. There'll be information there. and pre-order specials on the transcription book of Jerry Jamont. You can also check out his masterclass that he did at Lemur Music. There's three videos there. I chopped it up into a couple different videos. But it is the masterclass in its entirety. And if you would like a signed copy of Jerry Jamont's autobiography, all that information is there. Click on what you need to click on for what you want to engage with. It's all there, thebassshedacademy.org.
Excellent, sir.
How did you get into, you mentioned studying different facets of music. How did you get into writing and composing, arranging for TV and commercials and things? Because that seems, living in LA, I know that that's a tough little world to get into. Everybody who's in that world is pretty possessive about their gig, yeah, and who they let into the circle. Yeah. They don't want to lose the account. You know, they don't want somebody else being on the scene.
Yeah. Well, I did not work as far part of the jingle companies, the companies that jingles. I did work for 10 to 12 different jingle companies.
Okay.
So I was a hired gun doing those commercials and stuff. So I kind of knew what that was like. And I didn't like the politics of jingles, you know, the way they worked and competed for a spot. But I was okay with playing on those spots. But most of those guys that were arranging were friends. So I kind of learned what they were doing and how they were accommodating the 15-second, the 30-second, the 60-second spots, you know.
Yeah.
So you learn those little things. But I was more interested in doing background music for, a two-minute shot in a movie or in a television show, whatever.
Just some instrumental underscore.
So you would put some underscoring, exactly.
Okay.
And so, little by little, I started learning orchestration and things like that. I don't consider myself like an amazing orchestrator, but I do know what I want to hear. So, and so I'll get somebody, for example, on part two, I did this Spanish flamenco jazz a song that a friend of mine from Italy wrote.
Oh, nice.
And he's actually originally from Mexico, but he's been in Italy most of his life now as a professional musician. And I had another friend of mine who works currently with Gino Vannelli and other artists like that orchestrate, because he's a serious orchestrator.
The guy,
he got his master's and, you know, he worked with Mark Isham doing movies and, you know, did orchestration and stuff. So I had him orchestrate for this song, do all string orchestration. I said, you know, I don't want horns. I don't want timpanis or any of that stuff. I just want full on string orchestration for this piece.
Okay.
And we went down the whole arrangement and stuff, and he did it. It's remarkable.
How big of a group did he orchestrate for? Like 40 piece orchestra? Like, is it a really dense?
Dense.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Great. And then he had standouts, you know, violin standout, viola, cello. And so he did a phenomenal job. And then on top of it, he's a beast of a keyboard player. So I had him do some solo stuff.
Cool.
Well. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. So you mentioned from part one to part two. Part two has a little bit more to dig into. How would you? What are some characteristics that make part two a little bit more meaty?
The arrangements, the things
you just described with the
more involved. There's more depth. Yeah. Like I said, part one is more of an appetizer, and you know, great vibes and, you know, a little bit of variety of everything. Part two, it goes a little deeper, especially the instrumental music.
Okay.
As well as the rock stuff. I have a rock tune that's more metal-esque.
Okay.
Type of rock with vocals and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's pretty intense. And then it goes to total vocal groove with just bass and vocals some percussion, and then it goes into a whole salsa type of song with vocals, but like killer arrangement. I got these guys from San Diego and Mexico that are just do some ridiculous horn arrangements, you know?
Okay.
And so it's very, very intense, you know, very involved. And then there's another rock instrumental that's more fusion-like. And I got some crazy dudes playing on that. I don't want to mention names yet because I want it to be a surprise. But cool. You guys you'll know who they are. So.
Okay. I mean, you mentioned Gambale already earlier. I'm kind of curious if he makes an appearance.
Yeah.
Say anything. Don't give anything away. But I'm just curious.
I was just going to say that in part one, I had Guthrie Govan and Scott Henderson and Tim Miller and Doug Bossi already make an appearance on part one. So, and they killed it, of course.
Man, I was just talking about Henderson the other day. Yeah. A drummer who I'm sure is a mutual friend, if you know Andy Sinisi at all.
I don't know him personally. I know who he is.
But he used to do a trio with Henderson and Rufus Philpott. I was talking to Andy the other day. I'm like, dude, what happened to Henderson? Like, you just don't hear him around. He used to be at the Potato, like, every once in a while, you know.
Yeah.
Similar to, like, what Landau does. Like, every once in a while, he'll just have a night at the Potato.
Yeah.
I haven't heard much from him. How's he doing? Is he... okay health, everything all right? He always sounds amazing.
Yeah, I haven't talked to him recently because when he did his solo, that was about a year and a half ago that he did that. And he was fine. You know, we're all getting older. So, you know, I honestly don't know what he's up these days. I'm sure he gets out there and he's probably doing recordings at his place like everybody else.
Sure.
But I couldn't tell you exactly today. Yeah.
Right. There's no moment by moment update on Scott Henderson.
I've loved his playing with Tribal Tech for ages, you know.
Yeah.
Just love that band. And as a matter of fact, David Goldblatt, who's the guy that did the orchestration for me and also played keyboards, he was also with Tribal Tech. He did one of the records.
Those early records before it turned into a trio?
Before it turned into a trio. Yeah.
Because there was a couple trio records, and then Vital Tech Tones was the band that came out of that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I remember listening to all those, man. It was so over my head at the time, but I loved it. And I didn't know why I loved it. I just loved it and I had no idea what they're doing.
Yeah. Well, it's like Alan Holdsworth, who's left us.
Yeah.
Just amazing, amazing stuff.
Yeah. Did you ever work with Holdsworth?
I never worked with Holdsworth. I knew the guys that played with them, especially Chad Wackerman.
Sure.
Because, Chad is also in part one.
Okay.
He played in part one. And we were actually for Los Lobotomies, we were inviting Alan Holdsworth. This is just before he passed away. We were trying to get him on the record, but he was already having health issues.
Yeah.
And so we weren't able to get him because he had, passed away. And it was really sad. But, we found another cat from Boston. I think he came out of Berkeley. And his name is Tim Miller, and he's got that whole vocabulary.
Really?
As well. Yeah, just phenomenal.
That's Holdsworth had such a unique thing. That's
totally unique. Well, and that after so many years, he inspired a whole boatload of other guitar players. So there are quite a few cats that have that vocabulary out there. And this guy is one of them. His name is Tim Miller. He's a beast.
Awesome.
Great player. Awesome. You'll hear him on the solo there.
What tune is that again?
Mr. Bottomy.
Okay, yeah. That is track six on part one.
Yeah.
For all the listeners out there, yeah.
And his is the solo number three.
Okay.
Because first it's Guthrie, then it's Scott Henderson, and then it's Tim Miller. And then the last one is Doug Bossi, who's the guitar player for Los Lobotomies. Yeah.
Nice. Cool. How this is such an undergoing... a big project that encapsulates your whole career. What could possibly be after this? Like, is this just seems like such a heavy project that it's very much this is my life, this is my career vibe.
Yeah.
Is this kind of maybe subconsciously the final record you'll do? Do you think you'll do another project after this?
Yeah, I you know what I'll do after this is probably do singles. You know, mm-hmm. like I said, we had 30 to 35 tunes to pick from.
That's so much material.
I'm doing 21 as a whole, so it's
okay.
7 songs per part.
Yeah, okay.
And so there'll be plenty of.
You still got a bunch of stuff left on the editor's floor. Yeah.
And I'll just do singles from that point on.
Okay.
According to my schedule, because, you know, I still tour not as much as I want, not as much as I have to, let's say.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah.
You know, traveling is not as fun as it used to be. But there are certain people that I really enjoy traveling with. And Olita Adams is one of those people that I really enjoy working with because they're just the greatest folks, you know.
How long have you been with her?
Since 2008 or 2009.
Oh, wow. Okay.
There. Yeah, and we've become very close. We're more like a family. So it's a lot of fun.
That's great.
Then, of course, you know, when we get a chance to do lobotomy stuff, we'll do that. And I'm going to New York with David Garfield, and we're going to play at the Bitter End or something like that, one of those jazz clubs there. In New York City in October, and we'll have two guys from New York, drummer and guitar player from New York.
Oh, cool. Do you know who those guys are yet? Or is that just something Hammond's David Tanner?
No, it's I think it's the name is Dave Pinozzo.
Okay.
The other name will come to me. We'll be putting it up on our Facebook and Instagram and all that stuff. We'll be announcing it. So
cool, man. When we were talking before doing this, that's who I had heard you with. I heard you with Garfield at Mambo's.
Oh yeah.
Years ago when Mambo's.
Yeah, wow.
exactly. Yeah, back in the day.
Wow. Yeah.
I liked that club. I love that place.
I love the owners. I knew the owners really well. We were all like family, and they treated us so nice there. They fed us, they took care of us. They were all musicians too.
I had almost did a couple gigs there. I think with Mahesh, I can't remember.
Yeah.
But I never got a chance to play there. But everyone who did play there said the same thing, that the owners were very welcoming and supportive and loved the arts.
Yeah.
You were with Garfield. I think it was Oscar Seton. And I don't know who was on guitar, if there was guitar. Maybe Tony Paluzzi.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't remember.
No, Tony, no. He
wouldn't have done it.
Okay. Yeah, not for Mambo's. No, there was James Hara that played with us guitar, if there was guitar. And there was also a Cuban cat that played the tres. And I'm forgetting his name right now because I'm brain farting. But he was a phenomenal player from Cuba. He's played with us there. And but it's mainly been like trio, quartet, you know, sax player.
Okay, yeah,
sax,
I can't,
drums, bass,
I can't remember if there were was a fourth person. I feel like there was, but I can't really recall. But you and Oscar definitely left an impression. It was wonderful listening to both of you play.
Yeah, I love Oscar. He's great. Great player.
How long have you worked with Garfield?
We've known each other since the 80s.
Okay.
So back in the 80s... he was doing a lot of Baked Potato gigs with different groups. So they had Charisma, the band Charisma. There was Los Lobotomies. And there were other entities, groups of people. But those two were really like doing, you know, those two bands were playing a lot. They played a lot in town in the jazz clubs. But at the Baked Potato, when I moved into L.A. in 81, around 82, 83 is when I believe I met Dave, and I was introduced by one of the guys that that he had recorded with. I don't know if it was Luis Conte or one of, you know. Anyway, he called me out of the blue because I was recommended, and we did a gig, and you know, because he heard that I played different styles of music, and he was doing that, you know, in the catalog of music that he had.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did, and we hit it off, and Then we started doing recordings together and tours and whatnot, you know, and it just kept going. Then Los Lobotomies turned into a, because Los Lobotomies was basically a lot of the studio guys in LA, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was a pool of cats. So I wasn't the only bass player, you know, Willie was one of the cats and
okay.
Nathan East and Jimmy Johnson. And, you know, there was this whole pool of,
I never knew Will Lee to be out here.
No, but he would come, you know.
Oh, really? Okay, so he was still living in New York.
Oh, always.
Yeah,
always.
Okay, that's what I thought. Yeah. I've never, ever known Will Lee to live out here. That would have been a surprise.
He's come to L.A. We've sure. hung out in L.A., and he's come to the gigs and stuff. And when he's in town, he'll sit in and play. You know.
Killer.
But he's also played with the band and recorded with Los Lobotomies.
Okay.
Know? So if you listen to the original first Los Lobotomy CD, it's Will Lee.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
And he's always been a part of that. And we're all good friends.
Yeah.
But then what happened down the road is Steve Lukather got a record deal in Europe and he wanted to do a tour. But deciding whether he wanted to do Steve Lukather or Steve Lukather and Los Lobotomies.
Yeah.
And so, and because we already had been playing for so long in LA, Los Lobotomy became a cult following thing.
Okay.
Where everywhere we played was always sold out, you know?
Yeah.
Carlos Vega was playing and Greg Bissonette and Jeff Porcaro.
Okay.
You know,
it's just like a who's who session, guys.
Yes,
going through. Yeah.
Yes. They all played. And then in the 90s, because Luke was touring and Simon Phillips was already traveling with Toto,
mm-hmm.
he brought in Simon and we decided to do a quartet Los Lobotomies to okay. make it easy as far as, you know, four of us touring and, you know, the travel and the hotels and blah, 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 blah. And so we simplified it because normally there's percussion and there's horns and there, you know, stuff that when we played in town.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we toured Europe with that,
okay.
with that entity and, did really well. It was a killer band.
Yeah.
And, we opened for Aerosmith, for Peter Gabriel. Nice. I mean, it was ridiculous.
Nice.
It was great. And played all the huge festivals and stuff. And, you know,
that's killer.
Fun. It was a lot of fun. Yeah.
This project, Life Legacy, and music, what would be some key or important characteristics you think of your career that have helped sustain you in these generations, in these decades, I guess is a better way of saying it, these decades where technology has changed the game so quick? What are some parts of your career, some skill sets you have that have sustained you?
Well, one of the things, and this might sound trivial, but was learning the different tones and sounds of the instrument of my bass. Because when I, you know, in the 80s, we did a lot of live recording.
Yeah, yeah.
We were in the studio constantly. That whole decade was phenomenal.
Yeah,
because we were constantly in the studio doing records and commercials, etc. But you know, I would watch the keyboard players, and back then, you know, that was when everybody had all those stacked
keyboards. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You got like, right.
You know, they came in with the stack, and you'd hear all the different sounds, and yeah, producers say, "No, let's try this, let's try that." I'm like, wait, if he can do that, I can do that too.
Mm.
You know, I can bring different basses and tones and different variations and have something for that song that I think cuts better through that tune. So that gave me longevity. You know,
okay.
a lot of producers wanted to have me go in because they knew that I wasn't, you know, I didn't have just one sound.
Right.
So, and they knew that I would find the right sound that would work with that track. Right.
Sure.
And so they would give me some leeway to try a couple of different instruments and so learning the tones and understanding what instrument worked best with the track was one of the things that helped me, to gave me a longevity in that business, you know.
Within that idea of having a versatile palette of tones, how does effects come into that? Do you play with effects? Do you use effects in the studio? Do you always put that on post?
Yeah, when called for. Yeah, some of it's during in the studio, but I always record a separate track. So I always had a track with the clean bass, and then I'd have the track with the amplifier or with the pedals, you know.
Yeah, do you just do a line splitter, so it's the
line
same
split. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Use different, you know, a couple of different DIs, and so that way there was always full control of each sound.
Yeah.
So when it was called for, I'd use them. I still do. So.
What are some go-to effects that might always be part of the arsenal? Like, you know, I know a lot of guys swear by the Boss OC2, you know, and that's always going to be a part of their rig.
Right.
When using effects, are there some staples you always kind of check in with?
Well, depending
when you know you need a specific sound.
Yeah. Well, most of the time, if recording direct, bass itself comes with everything, because the pre's that they're built with is sonically, it's ridiculous. Yeah. So don't need much. But when it comes to like rock stuff, I these days for me it's more of the plugins. Mm. So I love the SVT Ampeg plugins, you know, with the different variation of speakers, you know, that you can use. And then I love, you know, I have a physical Sans amp, pedal, and to give it a little bit more raunchiness or a distortion if I wanted.
Okay.
So I use those, and then I have my pedal board, which, you know, has delay and reverb for a certain parts of the song where you want solos, you know, and the octaver, of course, you know, to if you're doing an arrangement where you want the section to sound fat, you know. So I just use them when they're called for, you know.
When selecting an effect, let's say it's an octaver, or let's say it's a delay, like you mentioned. What are some things you're listening for? Let's say it's a Boss delay versus like an MXR delay. And I'm not necessarily getting you to try to plug a product here. I'm just, when you're A-ing two different delay pedals, what are you listening for?
I'm trying to listen for something that doesn't color the bass too much.
Okay.
Because remember, as soon as you plug into a pedal, some of them gives your instrument a different color on tone.
Yeah.
And so if it changes it too drastically, I don't want that in there. So I'm trying to get a true bypass pedal.
Okay.
So what the name or the brand really doesn't matter to me, as far as, because delay is a delay, right? You get 2 milliseconds, you get 10 milliseconds, whatever, you're going to, that's what you get. It's a delay. But if it colors my instrument to the point where it's not recognizable, it's not my sound, then, you know, I put it off. Okay. So the delays that I use are more true bypass. The same thing with the octavers and, you know, compression. If I decide to use a compressor, everything has to be true bypass, so doesn't color the instrument. But other than that, you know, there's so many great pedals out there that.
Yeah, I know. And it's
ridiculous.
I find it as so many things. Anytime that there's the marketplace is so saturated, it's hard to sift through, you know.
Right.
If you say like, well, OK, I want to get a compressor for like my pedal board or something. Where do I even start?
Right.
You know, it's just so overwhelming. And it's always interesting to me to talk to cats like, what are you listening for? And so maybe that can help inform others who are on the pursuit to add some effects or to, okay, I'm going to listen to the true bypass thing to make sure it's not coloring my sound.
Another thing too is the way you chain your effects too.
Mm-hmm.
The order that you decide to put them in could change things for you as well. So you want to make sure that as you use, if you're using various effects, that one is complementing the other and not, you know, kind of interfering when you turn the last pedal in line versus the one that you have first. And then you have all these other assortment of pedals.
Right.
That it doesn't fight, you know, your sound, you know.
Yeah.
Or color it, you know, color it too much, where if you're playing clean, that it's not, you're not sounding like when you plug in directly into a DI, you know?
Yeah. After spending so much time in the studio, how do you get a studio, like what's your process or signal chain to get a studio quality bass signal when you're on the road or playing a live gig?
Well, back in the 80s and 90s, when I was going to the studios, I always bought my Neve. I had a 1073 and 1272s, and I always had those with me. Engineers love me for that, because they just plug in the XLR and grab the signal from there. I never really used the EQ. I just used it as going through the...
Like a saturator?
Saturator, yeah. Fattener, right, so to speak. And I also had the Manly Veritube, compressor. So that's what I used physically back then. These days, I can plug in directly to any UA Audio or Pro Tools setup. And because of the plugins that they have now that are, you know, Unison, you can use, you know, any of those same...
Right, any of those same tools.
Preamps and, you know, compressors and stuff. And I just use them to go through the signal of them. You know, the Manlys. I love the Manlys because they... Your bass just gets really thick, you know.
Yeah.
Without having to use the compression, you're just going through those tubes, you know.
How do you duplicate those sounds live? Do you even try to, or you just realize that studio, this is live, and I'm not going to get that same kind of...
No, because remember that when I'm recording, if I'm recording direct, the tube compressor, the Manly, does that. Mm-hmm. But then if I have an amplifier, I use mainly Trickfish amplifications or Aguilar.
Okay.
And I can emulate that with those amps.
Yeah. Trickfish, you know, is my
Trickfish
favorite.
Trickfish is so warm and punchy. Yeah. And
love Trickfish. I can't say enough great things.
Yeah. I can do rock and roll. I can do funk. I can do jazz. You know, you name it. I mean, it's great. And their speakers are ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, the selling point to me with them, this is not a Trickfish ad, although I have run those on this podcast, is it... My upright sounds great on it, and my electric sounds great on it.
Yeah.
And any electric, if it's a P, if it's a, you know, an active bass, the fretless, they all sound fantastic.
Yeah.
I was on a gig in Seattle a couple days ago, and like they had a rental upright for me, and I plug it in and run it through my Trickfish pre that I always bring. Yeah. And the drummer's like, "Man, that's a good sounding bass." I'm like, "Ha, it's a good sounding preamp." Like,
there you go.
You know, the bass is whatever. Like, Trickfish is the best.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. They are. I love those guys.
Same. Do you run compression live?
No, most of the time I don't, unless it's a certain type of music or style of a song that requires to cut through if there's a lot of music involved.
Right.
And I wanted to cut through, you know, or if I want to do a more type of distortion-esque solo without being too wide sounding, so it cuts through everything else that's happening musically. It all depends on the instrumentation, how many musicians we have on stage, what's the sound like.
Sure.
You know, if I need to cut through, I might use a little bit of compression. If most of the time I don't, to be honest.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So it sounds like you're always kind of wearing the producer hat. Always. I mean, those are all producer decisions.
Yeah. Yeah. I think of the big picture as who's playing, what's the sound like, you know, where do I fit in this, you know?
Yeah.
You know, because sometimes we play with orchestra.
Okay.
You know, and when there's a big, beautiful orchestra, you know, there's tone sounds that work best, so that you're not like rocking out and drowning the orchestra, you know?
Right.
Because I like to hear everything too. That, again, going back to the producer sound, I want to hear the full mix.
Sure.
Not just me, right?
Yeah, those are, I mean, I feel like those are very much bass player decisions, and that's a bass player brain to, okay, what's everything that's going on here, and where's my place in it to support it all?
Right.
Is it,
At what point in your career did you get to kind of transition more into taking on a producer role?
After working, I would say 20 years in the business.
Okay.
I watched some of my favorite cats, you know, producers that I was fortunate enough to work with, and see how they would work with the musicians and bring out the best in them in each yeah. musician, and how the interpretation of the song would come to life.
Mm.
And those things were very inspirational for me. And that's what I look forward to doing, you know, when I go into that role.
Yeah.
Is how to bring the best out of the person that's participating in the project, and bringing it, having their interpretation bring it to life, you know?
Yeah. So it's kind of a focus. Please correct me if I'm wrong. It's a focus on the social aspect of the music is incredibly important to you.
Yes.
Because working with these people and making sure it's a personal connection to fulfill a musical vision.
Right. Yeah. Right. But, you know, like I said, a lot of the musicians that that participate on the record, I know them either directly, we've had a long-term relationship, or I know of them and I know their work. So,
right.
So, you know, and basically it is just me giving them guidance to bring it to life, you know?
Yeah. That's killing, man. Life, legacy, and music. Part one is out. That's on all the streaming platforms.
It's all the streaming platforms. It's on, if you want to download, you can go to iTunes Store. Mm-hmm. If you know, and here I'm going to geek out here. 44116 on iTunes for download. But if you want a 96K24, which it really sounds much better for me personally, you can go to John Pena Music. It's Pena and not Pena, unfortunately, because they can't get the squiggly thing on the end.
Okay.
So it's johnpenamusic.bandcamp.com. Or you can just go to bandcamp.com and search me. And they have it in 96K, which sounds so much better.
Okay. Okay.
You can download it from 96 all the way to MP3, depending on, you know, what devices you're using to listen to. So they give you all the options.
Sweet. And then where can we go to get some updates about part two? Is that going to be on a personal website? Are you going
to? Yeah, it'll be on my Facebook page. I have two Facebook pages. One is a personal page, John Pena. Mm-hmm. The other one is a JP band page or John Pena band page. Either one, you'll get it on Facebook. It's my band page. And then I have an Instagram, JP Slam. On Instagram, and you'll get all the information there. Everything will be up.
Killer. Man, you got to come back on and talk about part two when it's out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's keep everybody engaged with this.
Yeah. Love to.
All right. That was my talk with John Pena. Be sure to check out part one of his project, Music, Legacy, and Music. Right, three parts. I'm still blown away by that. Check out part one and definitely stay tuned for the following two installments of the project. I'm really excited to hear those and to have John back on to talk about them and kind of give us all an in-depth, you know, kind of behind the scenes about the music and how the sessions went and all of that. It's a really exciting and inspiring project that he's doing there. If you are digging the Bass Shed podcast, please hit subscribe wherever you are listening to it, or find it wherever you get your podcasts. That's about all I got for this one, folks. I will catch you on the next one in a minute.